Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
That sort of capacity to achieve strategic ends short of shooting at each other. If Oman disappears tomorrow, that capacity to do that is gone as well.
You're listening to War College, a weekly podcast that brings you the stories from behind the front lines. Here are your hosts, Matthew Gault and Jason Fields.
Hello, welcome to War College. I'm Matthew Gault.
And I'm Jason Fields.
The Sultanate of Oman isn't a country we often hear about in the news, which is strange given its location. The country sits next to Yemen and Saudi Arabia and across the Gulf from Iran and Pakistan. Given its relationship and location, Oman is the most important country most people have never heard of. Here to help us understand it better is security specialist Tom Ordeman. Ordeman spent a year and a half as an anti-terrorist advisor in the Gulf region during the Arab Spring. His work has appeared in the Small Wars Journal, and he's also been a guest on the International Spy Museum's podcast and BBC Radio. So, Tom, what's the first thing people need to understand about Oman, especially those of us who don't know anything about the country?
So the first thing to understand is that there are a number of key things about Oman that just make it different than its neighbors. Some of the listeners will know that the Middle East, and particularly the Gulf region, was more or less colonized by the United Kingdom for many years, and that colonization period kind of ended in a phased withdrawal from what the British called East of Suez after about 1970. Oman was never a colony in the sense that the other nations were, but there's always been a very intimate relationship between Oman and the United Kingdom going back at least to the 1700s. Oman sits outside the Gulf itself, with the exception of the Musandam Peninsula, which is an exclave of Oman that is attached to Emirati territory. So it has a geographic relationship that ties a great deal to India and to Africa. So there are some cultural and historical links there that are absent elsewhere in the Arabian Peninsula. The people of Oman adhere, most of them, to a minority denomination of Islam called Ibadism, which actually split off from the main Sunni branch a number of years before the Shiite branch split off. So there are some religious differences that end up being key to differences in the culture and in Omani history. So between geography and culture and history, there's just a number of factors that have kind of pushed Oman into a unique position to really have an impact on a number of different global conflicts.
You make it sound like, well, let me understand something, actually. It's a peaceful place, at least compared to a lot of the other countries in the region. But it actually has strategic importance, right? I mean, what is it that it actually has to offer other than peace and quiet?
You know, obviously there's geographic elements that make it a strategic powerhouse. For example, because it sits outside the Gulf and because it has its own energy resources, although those are more modest than some of its neighbors, there are, you know, certainly some strategic economic factors at play there. As I mentioned, it's outside the Gulf, so you've got the proximity to different conflicts and friction zones within the Middle East without having to go through the Strait of Hormuz. That having been said, Oman controls one side of the Strait of Hormuz. So you actually, you know, a lot of people would look at that, you know, from a wide angle on a map and think, oh, it's the United Arab Emirates that's directly across from Iran. In fact, it's Iran and Oman that control that strait. And some of the listeners may remember from back in 2011 or 2012, there was some posturing by Iran claiming that they could mine the Strait of Hormuz, or, you know, kind of close that artery of global energy supplies off whenever they wanted. Well, they really couldn't. And part of the reason for that is that they would have drawn the ire of Oman in so doing. Part of the relationship between the different Gulf states is that Oman essentially becomes the Switzerland of the Middle East. So even though they're a member of the Gulf Cooperation Council, along with Kuwait, Bahrain, the Emirates, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia, they also conduct military drills with Iran and have close relations with Iran.
Let me jump in here real quick. First of all, I want to know more about its energy resources and its military. Does it have oil, and what's its military like?
So Oman does have oil. Its energy resources are considered maybe not much more modest, but noticeably more modest than those of its neighbors. So, you know, I spent a year and a half in Kuwait, and not to offend any Kuwaiti listeners, but I was very surprised that Kuwait has so much energy wealth, but you wouldn't know it from looking at the infrastructure. It looks like a third world country. You go to Muscat, you go to Salalah, and you may as well be driving down a road in Southern California. Because they have such modest energy resources, they have to be very careful with how that wealth is invested. And so they take very good care of what they build, but that also impacts how they make decisions with that money. Tying back into your second question about the military, they do have a military. As with other Gulf states, a lot of that military force is focused on what the Brits would call fast jets, what we would, you know, call jet fighters and that kind of thing. Very much looking at an air defense, interdiction, interceptor type capability. The Omani land forces, as far as I'm aware, have not been employed since a border dispute with Yemen. Back in 1987, they were on call during the Gulf War, but I don't believe that they actually participated in that conflict. Where Oman got involved was they invited Kuwaiti citizens who were displaced by the conflict to come stay in Oman, and they offered them, you know, lodging and basically took care of them for the duration of the conflict. So you see from a lot of Omani history that hospitality and the willingness to engage diplomatically is kind of their shtick.
If Oman ceases to exist, what happens to the Middle East?
Immediately what happens is not only the Gulf nations, but also the West lose a key intermediary. The Sultanate, and particularly His Majesty Sultan Qaboos, has been involved in a number of diplomatic efforts over the years, particularly between Iran and everybody else who isn't Iran. Listeners may remember from June 2004 and April 2007 when Iran detained British sailors and Marines. It was Oman that negotiated their release. They've cooperated with Iran on defense, but they've also cooperated and held drills with the United States. British officers are still seconded to the Omani military as advisors after many decades. There have been a number of hostages that have been released by Oman, not released by Oman. Oman has negotiated their release. The most recent one that I'm aware of was an Indian Catholic priest who was held in Yemen by ISIS, and he was released in September of 2017 because of intercession by Oman. The Iran nuclear deal, whether you care for it or not, the broker behind the scenes was Oman, and a number of those negotiations took place in Oman precisely because Oman has set itself up as a neutral third party that's friends with the West, friends with the other Gulf Arab monarchies, but also maintains this relationship with Iran. So that sort of capacity to achieve strategic ends short of shooting at each other, if Oman disappears tomorrow, that capacity to do that is gone as well.
During the Arab Spring, am I remembering right that Oman also ran into some trouble with minorities there?
Not so much with minorities. You're remembering more or less correctly. So what happened with in Oman was there you did have demonstrations. There was a supermarket that was burned down, and I believe there may have been also some protests in Muscat, the capital. I know for a fact that there were at least protests planned in Salalah. And what was interesting about it was in virtually all cases, as opposed to, you know, protests that we've seen in Iran that have said down with the dictator, or, you know, in other locales that, you know, like in Tunisia, where the longtime president was ousted, or the same in Egypt and Yemen, the protests were actually posed as supplication to Sultan Qaboos. So it was asking for his intercession to alleviate different grievances that different groups within the Sultanate held. That kind of points to a very interesting situation with the Sultanate. Sultan Qaboos remains exceptionally popular with his subjects. There's real anxiety about the prospect of an Oman after Sultan Qaboos.
Can you tell me what the source of that is? What kind of reforms has he done, or things that he's given to the people?
Before Sultan Qaboos, his father, Sultan Said, had some fairly antiquated ideas, was very austere in many of his beliefs, to the degree that people were not allowed to travel within the Sultanate. People were not allowed to wear glasses. There were only a couple of miles of actual paved roads in the entire country. There's a famous story that prior to Sultan Qaboos coming to power, Sultan Said's rule for Muscat was that a man was not allowed to be outside the city gates without a lantern or something to that effect. So before Sultan Qaboos took power from his father in 1970, we're talking about a country that was essentially like some of the villages we see in coverage of in Afghanistan, where there's no electricity, there's no education, there's no medicine. It's really, you know, it was living in the dark ages. And so Sultan Qaboos took power in a bloodless coup that is generally believed to have been assisted or at least condoned by the British government. That was in July of 1970, and his father went into exile in the United Kingdom for the remainder of his life. And Sultan Qaboos immediately embarked on what's now known as the Omani Renaissance. The first step of that was that Oman had previously existed as essentially a very loose confederation of Muscat, which was essentially the coastal areas of Oman, Oman proper, which was the mountainous inner region outside Muscat. You had Bahraini, which was kind of a contested area up north on the border of what's now the United Arab Emirates. And then down south near Yemen, you had an area called Dhofar. And so one of his first acts was to unify the country and say, this is no longer the Sultanate of Muscat and Oman. We are now the Sultanate of Oman. We are a unified country. And then he enacted, you know, sent not only boys but also girls to school. So Oman has an exceptionally well-educated populace, including women who hold jobs commensurate with those of men. He pushed electricity and just, started with the basics and built a country that was basically in the Stone Age into what is now a modern country.
So all of that, is that why there's no Islamic State, or is there an Islamic State branch there? All of the terrorist groups that we've all come to know and not love, nothing in Oman at all.
No. So I've never heard any mention of Oman connected with ISIS, Daesh, the Islamic State, what have you. There have been a very small handful of Omanis from the minority Sunni community who have ended up being captured or killed in Afghanistan. But this goes back to ISIS and Al-Qaeda and most of the major insurgent, militant, terrorist groups in the Middle East subscribing to either Sunni or, you know, in the case of some of the groups sponsored by Iran, Shiite ideology. Very sort of splinter extremist on whichever side of that. Oman is Ibadi, so they're not tied to either of those sort of opposition extremist factions. So there's a very small demographic from which any of those groups would even try to recruit from Oman. So very little of that. What you did see, and this is essentially long since passed, is in the 1960s, there was the Jebel Akhtar War between 1956 and 1959. And that was between Sultan Saeed, the current Sultan's father, and the Ibadi religious authorities that were in the Omani Mountains outside Muscat. But you did have a lengthy insurgency that was sponsored initially just by tribal leaders who were disillusioned with Sultan Saeed's rule, and later were co-opted by communist insurgents in neighboring South Yemen. So that's about the closest thing they've had to an actual insurgency.
All right, War College listeners, we're going to take a break right there. We're on with Tom Ordeman Jr., and we're learning about Oman. We'll be back after this message from our sponsors.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
All right, thank you, War College listeners. Welcome back to the podcast. We are talking to Tom Ordeman Jr., and we are learning all about Oman.
So let me ask, Qaboos is ailing, right? So what comes next? Does he have a son or daughter who is going to step into the breach and continue things as they are, or is there now a danger after his death?
Well, that is the million real question, isn't it? Sultan Qaboos was married very briefly to one of his cousins, and that marriage did not produce an heir. The rumor is that he has a safe or a desk drawer or something that has an envelope in it with instructions and or his choice for a successor, and that upon his death, that envelope is to be opened, and then essentially his family has the clock starts ticking for them to make a decision of how to proceed. There are some potential successors. From what I understand, his cousin, Assad bin Tariq, who was appointed a couple of years ago as the Deputy Prime Minister for International Relations and Cooperative Affairs, and who has also served as Sultan Qaboos's personal representative. Many believe that he's favored to win. He also has a son named Taimur bin Assad. He's quite a bit younger, obviously, because he's a son of the Sultan's cousin. That would set up a sort of succession that would be sort of similar to what we're seeing in places like Qatar and Saudi Arabia, where you have an older successor who is then poised to pass on power to a younger son. There are a couple of other brothers of Assad bin Tariq. Haitham bin Tariq is the heritage and culture minister. Shihab bin Tariq is the former commander of the Royal Navy of Oman. And then there's an outside chance that a cousin from another branch, Fahad bin Mahmoud, who's been the deputy prime minister for the Council of Ministers, that he could be a potential option. My understanding is that he has a European wife and so has a son of mixed ancestry, so there's some speculation that that would dissuade the Sultan from choosing him as a successor. But those are kind of the key candidates at this point.
That strikes me as no way to run a country. Isn't that a really great way to set the next generation up for some sort of succession war?
The smart people who have been following this longer than I have don't believe that's the case. They believe that this system with the mysterious envelope actually puts the Sultan's remaining family members in a position where they have to come to a consensus themselves, similar but not exactly like what's happened in former successions in the Saudi royal family, where there was somebody in line, but essentially the Saudi royal family, that inner circle of the family, had to agree on who was going to be the next crown prince or who was going to be the successor. I think it's the theory is that this system gives the opportunity for sincere buy-in. And by only having a handful of eligible folks, I suspect that it'll probably be a smooth transition.
So what you're telling me is that there's a very peaceful, economically stable, politically stable actor in the Middle East that's rational, is friends with the West, and is trying to get everything smoothed out.
That may be putting it a little bit with too much of a bow on it. I mean, if you look at the economic piece, they do have a desire to diversify their economy. Just like any of the other, petro states in the Gulf, there's anxiety over where the future of the oil market is going to go. So they're, for example, they've made efforts to shore up their port facilities. There's a brand new port, I believe it's in a city called Duqm, that's kind of out in the middle of nowhere on the coast of the Indian Ocean. Their main port is in kind of the second city of Oman, which is Salalah. And so they're trying to increase traffic to those ports. They're trying to increase tourism, doing so in a responsible way. There's also the question of what are all these Omanis going to do? The total population of Oman, if I remember correctly, is about 3 million, but there are a lot of expatriate laborers in that demographic. And so there's been a push over the last several years for Omanization or Omanification of the workforce that has met with mixed results, similar to many of the other Arab Gulf monarchies. It's very attractive to have a sinecure position at the oil ministry or some other ministry or some state-sponsored company where, the ramifications of what you do aren't critical. But there is progress along those lines. But so it's not all rainbows and butterflies, as Maroon 5 might say, but overall, yeah, Oman is this amazing country that has been able, largely through the wisdom of Sultan Qaboos, to avoid a lot of the problems that we see elsewhere in the Middle East. It really is an amazing country that nobody's ever heard of.
You're really hurting our brand of terrifying the audience.
Well, how about this? Where is Oman next door to? There is no shortage of anxiety. In fact, I saw an article this morning in Al Monitor about Omani anxiety over what's going on in Yemen. There's, been a civil war in Yemen now, you know, really going on for a very long time, but specifically since around 2011, and there were skirmishes before that. The Omanis have relations, they have a great deal of influence in the easternmost province of Yemen, which I believe is called Al Mara province. Obviously they share a border there. And so their Al Mara province has not been impacted, in the way that many other areas of Yemen have, such as, Aden and Sana'a and what have you. But the Omanis are anxious about that. In particular, you know, they have to be looking at what's gone on the last few days, where you've got an Emirati-backed faction that is allegedly angling for secession from the rest of the country. That war that Oman fought, the civil war that took place in the southwest province of Dhofar in the 1960s and 70s, that was sponsored by communist insurgents in South Yemen. So there's definitely a memory in the case of Oman of what happened in the 1960s and 1970s, and I think they would very much like to avoid having to worry about that in the future. And so Yemen has given them some anxiety, and that's part of why they've remained diplomatically engaged. I know that at some point before his recent death, Ali Abdullah Saleh, the former president of Yemen, had briefly been in exile in Oman. There was another Yemeni opposition figure, Ali Salem al-Baid, who I don't know if he's still in Oman, but he had taken up refuge in Oman at least for a while as part of a deal negotiated by the Sultanate. So between them and the Indian priest that I mentioned earlier, there's certainly continued interest in and diplomatic intervention in Yemen, but that's got to keep the Omanis up at night.
Well, thank you so much, Tom. Really appreciate you taking us through this.
No problem.
All right, War College listeners, that does it for this week's episode. Thank you so much for listening. War College is me, Matthew Galt, and Jason Fields. If you like the show, please like and subscribe on iTunes. It is really helpful for us that it helps other people find the show. You can follow us on Twitter @war_college and on Facebook @facebook.com/warcollegepodcast. We'll see you next week.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.